Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, September 25th, 2017. A man who hails from what is now South Sudan, accused of shooting to death an American woman and injuring six others in a Tennessee church over the weekend.
There was a church usher who confronted the gunman. During the confrontation, the church usher was pistol-whipped. There was a significant struggle between the two.
And Amnesty International says it has turned up evidence of South Sudanese government officials buying weapons in 2014 from a company based in the UK.
And this is a particular concern because there are very stringent restrictions on UK trading arms with South Sudan, including an EU-wide embargo on arms.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Police say a 25-year-old suspect has confessed to a deadly church shooting near the city of Nashville in the southern U.S. state of Tennessee. One person was killed and six wounded. Emmanuel Kadega Sampson is expected to appear in court tomorrow. Sampson came to the U.S. from what is now South Sudan 2 decades ago and is a legal resident but not a U.S. citizen. Nashville police spokesman Don Aaron says a man at the church stopped the attack.
There was a church usher who confronted the gunman. During the confrontation, the church usher was pistol-whipped. There was a significant struggle between the two. During the struggle, the gunman shot himself, probably not intentionally, in the left pectoral muscle, in the left chest.
Sampson is charged with first-degree murder. He reportedly had attended the church in the past. Investigators have not given a possible motive for the shooting. Research by Amnesty International reveals negotiations for a massive arms deal between a company in the United Kingdom and the South Sudan government during 2014, worth $46 million. Patrick Wilkin, Amnesty's researcher on arms control and human rights in London, says the research is based on a number of contract documents and end-user certificates between the intermediary and the South Sudan government. Wilkin says the paper trail also shows negotiation documents of entities based in the Ukraine and the United Arab Emirates. But the British-based company, S Profit Limited, is the one that caught his team's attention.
And this is a particular concern because there are very stringent restrictions on UK trading arms with South Sudan, including an EU-wide embargo on arms. And it's very much contrary to UK policy. And so this company, which is run by a Ukrainian national, we believe, is essentially operating illegally here in the UK and is a symptom of wider problems in the UK with the use of shell companies to facilitate arms deals.
Do we know anything else about S Profit Limited? Have they made past deals similar to this one?
Yes, well, we have seen other documents of negotiations involving S Profit to other destinations which could be problematic, including Egypt and Rwanda. And as far as we know, S Profit has never applied for or obtained any license or authorization from the UK authorities to enter into these negotiations.
And I understand that S Profit Limited is denying this report.
S Profit Limited has sent us two very short letters denying that they have supplied weapons to South Sudan. We tried to follow up on that statement, and we sent the documentation we had citing S Profit in these documents that relate to the arms trade with South Sudan. But they never really engaged with the substance of our questions.
Now, as you said before, this transfer is contrary to UK policy. Amnesty also says that this was able to happen because of regulatory gaps. Can you explain that?
Yes, well, I think the gaps are on both sides. First, anyone with an internet connection and about $15 can set up a company in the UK without any requirement for verifying their true entity, identity or good standing, which seems like a crazily open system that's really ripe for abuse. And then on the other side, this is a call that we've made on the UK authorities for many years. There is no kind of regulatory body that has a register of all arms traders operating in the UK, and that obliges anyone trading arms to kind of report on their business activities. So that really opens it up for people, companies like S-Profit, to set up just a front shell company, a brass plate company, in London, in order to facilitate negotiations for, you know, highly irresponsible and illegal arms transfers.
Could you help me understand why an intermediary is needed in the first place? Why can't the sale transfer go from Ukraine directly to South Sudan?
There's many reasons why it might be useful to have a London address. It gives access to the banking system in Europe and dollar accounts. And also, it gives a sort of reputational gloss on any transaction that might not, a London address might not raise the red flags to regulatory authorities that other jurisdictions might. And in this case, we have not proven, but we've heard suggestions that there was some corrupt intent and that S-Profit was being used to siphon funds from the deal.
And what roles and responsibilities does the UK government have for matters like this?
They have a very grave responsibility because, you know, essentially a company is operating illegally in their jurisdiction and facilitating the transfers of arms that could cause, very, very serious human rights violations in the South Sudan. So, you know, the UK authorities need to urgently investigate this case, close down this company, and then close the very evident loopholes in their systems for regulating arms brokers.
That's Patrick Wilkin, Amnesty International researcher on arms control and human rights. He was speaking to me earlier today from London. A marathon organized by a group called South Sudan Great Run has raised 10 million South Sudanese pounds to feed the needy. The South Sudan government distributed 40 tons of food over the weekend to inmates at Juba Central Prison, patients at Al Sabah Children's Hospital, and children at a Juba orphanage. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Ayesha Shamtika, an Ethiopian businessman who owns the Dembish Hotel in Juba, heads the committee which organized the South Sudan Great Run in April. High-profile runners from Ethiopia and Kenya were invited to take part, including Hela Gabriel Selassie, a retired long-distance runner. Tika says the 10 million South Sudanese pounds were raised from South Sudanese and friends who participated in the marathon.
This is a local initiative. We are not taking anything from outside. This money we initiate from the people of South Sudan, institutions and organizations and different peoples in South Sudan.
With the money that was raised, South Sudan Minister of Cabinet Affairs Martin Ilia Lamuru says the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs bought 2,600 sacks of maize flour and beans and distributed the food to vulnerable South Sudanese in 15 different locations across Juba.
It includes children, it includes hospitals, it includes prisons, it includes all those areas of our community, of our society that are vulnerable.
The first group to receive food was Juba Central Prison, where officials are struggling to feed the more than 900 inmates. Speaking in Arabic, Juba Central Prison Director Brigadier General Michael Malau appreciates the donation, but says the prison still needs more food.
These 400 sacks that we received today contain beans and maize flour. They will greatly help the inmates here, including some really vulnerable ones, men, women, and juvenile prisoners.
Dr. Felix Nyongora, acting executive director at the Sabah Children Hospital, says he is struggling to provide food to hundreds of children and their mothers admitted at the hospital. But the food donation will make a difference.
Our patients don't have feeding program. This one will help them. I'm very happy about that.
Lucia Thomas-Laura, deputy matron at Juba Teaching Hospital, says many patients don't have food, but the 300 sacks of food she received will alleviate the shortage in food.
They are now assisting our patients because they are receiving, some of them are receiving medication without even feeding. Without feeding, I think we are not doing anything. This is very good for us today to receive this food to distribute it to our patients.
The South Sudan Great Run also donated food to Juba Orphanage, where 50 children between the ages of 2 to 17 are housed. Angelo Kenyi Samuel, the orphanage director, says he largely depends on individual donors and organizations because Jubek state government lacks resources to support the orphanage. Speaking in Arabic, he says, the 100 sacks of food he has received will feed the children at the orphanage for some time.
They used to give us 15,000 South Sudanese pounds monthly, but because of what the country is going through, we have not received anything, not even our salaries, for almost 6 months now, and we are very grateful for what we have received today.
Other recipients of the food donation include Khalwa Sheikh Dafa'Allah at Juba Mahad, Luri Widows, and Stone International Church. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Some South Sudanese who were deported from Israel in 2012 and a year later fled from Juba to Uganda when the fighting broke out say life in Uganda's refugee settlements is tough. Many say they are prepared to risk the dangerous journey back to Israel through the Sinai Desert in Egypt. Simon Peter Piku has the story for VOA from Kampala.
Nearly all South Sudanese who went to Israel traveled there illegally from Egypt with the help of Bedouin Arab smugglers who sneaked immigrants to Israel through the Sinai Desert. Israel deported hundreds of South Sudanese after South Sudan became an independent country in 2011. When the conflict broke out in 2013, many South Sudanese, including those who were deported, fled to Uganda. Instead of going to the refugee camps, the deportees opted to live as urban refugees in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Mary Nyalifa, a mother of two in her early 30s, says she has no intention of returning to South Sudan. Nyalifa stays with a friend in a Kampala suburb and sells tea and coffee to support her children's education. Simon Malwan, another deportee from Israel who also decided to stay in Kampala, says he was fortunate to have a relative who agreed to support him and pay his tuition at the Makerere College, where he studies public health. Manuel says he would rather return to Tel Aviv, where he lived for 6 years.
The life is very nice. There's a job, so it's good, better than Africa.
Nijang Gatkuoth, who was also deported back to South Sudan after living for 5 years in Israel, says life is tough in Uganda compared to Israel. Speaking in Arabic, the single mother, who worked at a hotel around Israel's Dead Sea region, says she yearns to return to Israel.
In fact, I had a peaceful life in Israel. There were no problems and the authorities allowed us to work and earn money to cater for our needs.
Nyalifa says she lost most of her relatives, including her husband, in the conflict that broke out in South Sudan in 2013. She says life is tough for urban refugees like her in Kampala.
And my situation now is bad. No one to help me. I'm alone. Even my husband, they're killing me.
Manuel says he wants to travel back to Israel after completing his studies in Kampala.
If there is a chance, I can go back, but we need money. No money.
Manuel says although he would be happy to leave Uganda and return to Israel, he is aware things did not exactly turn out well for some who attempted the trip back.
There are some people who try to go back there and then he default back again.
South Sudanese refugees who prefer to stay in the cities like Kampala often find it even harder to make ends meet. and resettling in a third country, which is the dream of many refugees, is an option only open to a fraction of the refugee population in Uganda. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Thousands of South Sudanese schoolgirls enroll in school after receiving a donation for tuition fees. Find out more when we come back.
South Sudanese in the diaspora have mixed reactions about what is happening in their country. This week, South Sudan in Focus host John Tanza engages the diaspora in a spirited discussion about what South Sudanese should do to bring peace in their country.
Unity is possible when we stop the hate.
What are we not doing to bring peace for our country?
The voices of the diaspora on ending the conflict in South Sudan. This week on South Sudan in Focus.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What advice would you give to a young parent?
For a young parent, he should find out how he can sustain the wife and the baby at the moment. Like, he should not sit idle by just waiting or for the mother of the child to be the one to run up and down.
We should focus on our family because there are so many other factors that will derail our attention from our family. We should have friends, yes, but the friends we should make is the friend that help us to build this family.
I would advise a young parent to, like, they don't know anything about being a parent, visit friends or even ask their own parents how to parent a child, the things to do when they are crying, when they are misbehaving.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese in the diaspora say the solution to end South Sudan's conflict is in the hands of the citizens. Civil society activists and community leaders in the U.S. say several attempts to end the conflict have failed because the process was not inclusive. John Tanza engages the diaspora in a series of panel discussions on how to end South Sudan's nearly four-year conflict.
My name is Nelson Ong. I have a background in information technology, and I'm also running a non-profit organization called Life Program. I'm really concerned about what is happening in South Sudan.
Thank you. Let's go to my sister. Are you there?
Yes.
Introduce yourself, please.
My name is Anyukor Ashuel. I live in Connecticut. I work for the Housing Authority of City of New Haven in Connecticut.
Let's go to you, Jonkur. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Jonkur Mayol. I'm a director of Concerned Citizens of South Sudan. It is a non-profit organization advocating to bring the peace and stability in South Sudan.
Thank you very much. And finally, William Pei, tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is William Pei. I am executive director of the Nile Institute for Peace and Development. We are operating in Phoenix, Arizona. We do community platforms, more of forums that talk about peace.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for sparing your time to speak about issues that are very important to our country, South Sudan. Our topic of discussion today is, what should South Sudanese do to end the conflict in their country? And the reason why this question was brought up is because a lot of South Sudanese are looking towards the international community to find a solution to their problems. I'll start by going to you, Nelson, in Khartoum.
Thank you, John. Before I jump into the whole topic, let me say this, that peace, it is a key to nation building. It is an element for unity and freedom of citizens in the country. And South Sudanese have really suffered enough. There are a few things that we have to look at it. One, we should look for a homegrown solution to our own problems, not looking at the international communities. And that is by looking at ourselves, we are from one tribe. In that, we are also brothers and sisters. We don't look at ourselves as enemies. We should look at ourselves as one people residing in one country. And also look at the opportunities in the country, that all these opportunities belong to all of us. No one is above others, including presidency. That we can, anybody who has the zeal to be a leader can be a leader. And also looking at the issue of the land and forceful occupation, because this is one of some of the signs of the symptoms of the conflict that has been generating in the country.
All right. Let's go to my sister, Anyikor. Did I pronounce it well?
Yes, Anyikor.
Yes, Anyikor. Nelson is raising some issues here. He has thrown a very big word here, homegrown solution. I would leave that aside for discussion later, but let's hear from you. What do you think South Sudanese should do to end the conflict in the country?
So this is a serious issue. So my opinion is that you can't wait for somebody from outside to fix your own problems. So for us as a South Sudanese, you know, we know there's a lot of problem we have right now. We know there's a lot of problem. Even with the second peace agreement that we have, in my opinion, they need to revisit it because I read it. It's not for all South Sudanese. If you did that peace agreement, so all of you, you know, online here, read the peace agreement. That peace agreement is benefit only two parties. It's not for all South Sudanese because there's some. We have a lot of people that would. It's not within that group of people.
William Pei, what is your take on this? Anyikor is saying that the peace agreement seemed to be designed for only two people or two parties. Do you subscribe to that?
Partially, John, and if I can just take a step back to the grand view of the whole idea of ending this conflict, and then conclude with what Sister Anyikor say in regard to the peace. Yes, there is a need for inclusivity. We need a platform. If you look at the current conflict, it is really very multi-faceted conflict. So it is no longer an SDLM conflict. I think there are so many things, the land issue and communal issues and grievances from previous conflict or split. There has to be a comprehensive approach to this conflict. With regard to ending the war, the people that are supposed to help us, the credibility of the leadership, the credibility of the mediators is in question. Therefore, we need neutral, more inclusive form in order for us to address this conflict altogether.
Jonkur, what do you think about William Pei's suggestions that we need to have a comprehensive approach to the conflict? What is your take on it?
Thank you, John, for having me again. I would start with my brother, you know, Nelson, with this point that we need a home-growing solution. How do the government value the citizen? The reason I'm saying that, because people of South Sudan have been behind the SPLM, SPLX since, you know, the struggle, and we voted for referendum, and we gained independence in 2011. Right now, the same government that we are supporting turns against their own people. I'm not, you know, disputing that we cannot have a home-growing, you know, solution. It can happen. But with mistrust that we have now, how that can be possible? I think I can agree with my sister, Nyankol, and also with Brother William, that this peace, it has to include all the stakeholders. It doesn't have to be only SPLA in government and SPLA IO. It's all South Sudanese, you know, from all the backgrounds, have to sit down and diagnose this problem. Because if problem is not solved, you know, from the root cause, there is no way we can get out of this mess. There is a need for renegotiation. The reason I'm saying that, it's Addis Ababa agreement. Actually, President has a reservation. As a result of that reservation, we is led into a chaotic situation again, because this peace actually is not going anywhere.
And when we talk about homegrown solutions, Nelson, could you give us one example? Because somebody in Juba would tell you the national dialogue is an example of a homegrown solution, where the president is asking people to all come into one room and talk about the issues, talk about the grievances, talk about the root causes of the conflict. So what kind of homegrown solution are you thinking about, Nelson?
John, the homegrown solution that I'm talking about is the one that studied the root causes of the conflict, okay? But the one that the president is doing, that one is only focusing on the reconciliation. It does not examine what caused this conflict. If we were to go back there and look at ourselves, that we are all one people, one community, I believe that we will generate that homegrown solution from there. Looking at ourselves, that the other people are not our enemies. They are actually our own citizens. We will now produce that homegrown solution. Once we sit on the table, that homegrown solution will come.
South Sudanese community leaders and activists discussing ways of ending the conflict in South Sudan. Tomorrow, panelists share their thoughts on what can unite South Sudanese in the second part of our series on Voices of the Diaspora. An initiative advocating for girls' education in South Sudan supports thousands of schoolgirls with a cash amount of 2,900 South Sudanese pounds each to encourage girls to remain in school. The project, known as GESS, targets pupils across South Sudan between primary 5 and senior 4, whose parents cannot afford to pay school fees. Tito Justin has the details for VOA from Juba.
Enrollment in South Sudan schools this year stands at a record 1.49 million pupils, and 44.5% of them are girls. An estimated 215,000 girls in 2,000 schools across South Sudan will receive cash transfers from Girls Education South Sudan, or GES. Akuja Mading de Garang is the team leader for GES.
This is a great opportunity, I have to say, that we should not misuse to ensure that our girls continue to go to school. It is now a good time for us to break the barriers of what that were preventing us and our girls from going to school and bringing us out of the cycle of poverty. It's an opportunity that has been offered to us by the UK government, and we need to take advantage of that.
The aid from the United Kingdom supports the cash transfer project. In the last 3 years, the UK aid donated £300,000 to 184,000 girls, and education officials say the money allowed thousands of South Sudanese girls to go to school. Yar is a 15-year-old pupil at St. Kizito Primary School, one of the beneficiaries of the program over the past years. Yar says since she started receiving the money, she has been able to meet her needs and has had a perfect attendance record.
This program of ours has helped a lot of girls. We come to school now every day because we are able to get this money. We buy for us books and what. Many of us are dropping out from school because lack of money.
In Juba, some schoolgirls complain that they often miss class because they cannot afford sanitary pads. 15-year-old Abuk of St. Kizito Primary School says the money she receives allows her to buy pads.
It's sometimes hard to buy these pads, maybe always. It's difficult for us to buy because last year it was cheaper and today it's expensive, 150 South Sudanese pounds. This we cannot afford. By your help, we can now be able to afford.
Scopus Korsuk is a representative of the Parents and Teachers Association at St. Kizito Primary School. He says the GES program has helped to dramatically reduce the school dropout rate among girls.
It has saved us in our poverty and then in educating our children. As this one started, we as teachers, we feel happy because we are no longer losing some of our girls, because previously, by this time, I think we should have a lot of dropout from the school.
Michael Lopuke, the undersecretary in the Ministry of General Education and Instruction, says the program targets girls because many South Sudanese girls were not in school in the past because of negative cultural practices.
This program is an affirmative action. An affirmative action in order to create the balance in balanced society. So I hope all of us, with the right sense of what, of reasoning, should be able to advocate and inform the boys that this situation is to help your sisters, because your sisters have more problems than you, although of course all of you have problems.
The UK aid also helps to pay teachers extra allowances. Earlier this year, education officials acknowledged that only 27% of the South Sudan population know how to read and write. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Sitcha Lost by Eddie Kenzo. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. We'd like to hear your comments about the show. You can reach us online at southsudan@voanews.com or find us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Sitalo si, 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 sitalo si
Wange no sawa ya nungo Bagande sagala nyombo Eno sawa ya chekire Mwama sembera Mulamu wasawa Jangu tetare Yansiri akoleka Mekanzine Nenzina muma